This is the Sunday Catholic Word, a production of Catholic Answers, the only podcast to look at the Sunday Mass readings from an apologetics perspective.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Sunday Catholic Word podcast, where we reflect on the upcoming Sunday Mass readings and pick out the details that are relevant for explaining and defending our Catholic faith. I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and the host for this podcast. In today's episode, we're going to focus on three details that have significance for apologetical discussions. The first two, which will take up most of our time, come from the second reading, which is taken from Hebrews chapter 7, verses 23 through 28. The relevant topics there are the sacrifice of the Mass and the intercession of the saints. And the detail from the Gospel reading, taken from Mark chapter 12, 28b through verse 34, relates to the topic of justification and its relation to love. So let's start with the second reading. Here's what the author of Hebrews writes. The Levitical priests were many because they were prevented by death from remaining in office. But Jesus, because he remains forever, has a priesthood that does not pass away. Therefore, he's always able to save those who approach God through him, since he lives forever to make intercession for them. It was fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, higher than the heavens. He has no need, as did the high priest, to offer sacrifice day after day, first for his own sins and then for those of the people. He did that once for all when he offered himself. For the law appoints men subject to weakness to be high priests, but the word of the oath, which was taken after the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. The first detail that I want to focus on is the author's statement, Jesus is always able to save those who approach God through him, since he lives forever to make intercession for them. This detail relates to the topic of the intercession of the saints, and it does so in two ways. First, some Protestants might appeal to this passage and argue that since Jesus is our heavenly intercessor, there cannot be others like the saints. In other words, there's not enough room in heaven for multiple intercessors. But if that's the case, then we'd have to reject the heavenly intercession of the 24 elders in Revelation 5:8 and the angel in Revelation 8:3-4. Here's what John sees in Revelation 5:8. When he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders, which given exegetical grounds, leads us to the conclusion that these are human souls, fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and with golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. In Revelation 8:3-4, John describes an angel doing the same thing. And another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to mingle with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense rose with the prayers of the saints from the hand of the angel before God. The prayers of the saints in both passages refers to Christians on earth. So I argue in my new book, The Saints Pray for You. And the 24 elders and the angel are presenting their prayers to the Lamb, Jesus, in the heavenly throne room. Friends, that's heavenly intercession. If the elders in Revelation 5:8 and the angel in Revelation 8:3-4 can be heavenly intercessors without taking away from Christ's unique mediation as our heavenly high priest, well then, so can the saints. There is, in fact, enough room in the heavenly throne room for multiple intercessors, especially when those other intercessors intercede with Christ in virtue of their union with Christ through grace. Second, rather than the statement by the author of Hebrews providing evidence against the intercession of the saints, I argue it actually provides support. Again, I do this in my book, The Saints Pray for You. Consider that in many instances, the Bible speaks of us being transformed to be like Christ. For example, Paul writes in Romans 8:29, those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. And you can also check out 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 49 through 52, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18, and 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 4, where it talks about our conformity to the Son. And we know that that transformation will be complete in heaven. We can take a look, for example, at 1 John 3:2. Beloved, we are God's children now. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Here is where our focus detail comes into play from the second reading. Recall, the author of Hebrews says in 7:25 that Christ, as priest of the heavenly temple, always lives to make intercession. If Christ always lives to make intercession for Christians on earth, and the saints are going to be perfectly like Christ, it's at least reasonable to think the saints would be doing what Christ does, namely, interceding for Christians on earth. And since Christ's intercession involves knowledge of Christians on earth, even specific knowledge, it's reasonable to infer that such knowledge would be shared with the saints who participate in that intercession. So, we have this detail of Christ always living to make intercession relating to the topic of the intercession of the saints by way of the saints in heaven imitating Christ and being conformed to Christ, which would involve conformity to what he does by way of intercession. The second detail that I want to focus on here is the second reading is the inspired author's teaching that Christ offered himself, quote, once and for all, close quote. Here's what he writes. Jesus has no need, as did the high priest, to offer sacrifice day by after day, first for his own sins and then for those of the people. He did that once for all when he offered himself. Now, many of our Protestant friends appeal to this passage as evidence for the claim that the Catholic understanding of the Mass as the quote-unquote divine sacrifice, in which Christ is quote-unquote contained and offered, quoting paragraph 1367 from the Catechism, that this stuff contradicts the Bible. If Christ offered himself once and for all, so it's argued, then how can Catholics say he's offered at the holy sacrifice of the Mass? I deal with this objection in my book, Meeting the Protestant Challenge, How to Answer 50 Biblical Objections to Catholic Beliefs, but I'll share a few of those ideas here. You'll have to read this chapter in the book for more information on it, for more details. First, the objection makes a false assumption about the Catholic doctrine of the Eucharistic sacrifice. The once-for-all statement in this verse comes within the context of contrasting Jesus' sacrifice for sins with the sacrifices that the Jewish priests had to offer on a daily basis. The author of Hebrews is making the point that Jesus doesn't have to offer regular animal sacrifices because his one sacrifice was sufficient to forgive the sins of all people through all time. Jesus has no need, the author says, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily. He did this once for all when he offered up himself. The Catholic doctrine of the Eucharistic sacrifice would contradict this biblical teaching if it entailed a re-crucifixion of Jesus. Because remember, the author is saying there's no need for another sacrifice. If we're saying that the Mass is another sacrifice of Jesus, well then yeah, the Catholic theology of the Mass would contradict this passage. But that's not the case. The Eucharistic sacrifice, so we profess, is not another sacrifice of Christ, as if Christ were repeatedly shedding his blood and dying. His bloody offering on the cross was a one-time event in the past and is never to be repeated. The offering in the Eucharistic celebration, however, represents without blood, without making Jesus suffer and die anew, that one historical sacrifice. The Catechism explains it as such in paragraph 1367, citing the Council of Trent. The sacrifice of Christ and the sacrifice of the Eucharist are one single sacrifice. So the Catechism affirms, states, and then quotes the Council of Trent. The victim is one and the same now who offers through the ministry of the priests, who then offered himself on the cross. Only the manner of offering is different. So the victim and the priest is one and the same, and so therefore it's the same sacrifice. Inasmuch as the Church's doctrine of the Eucharistic sacrifice affirms that Christ died once on the cross and that he does not and cannot die again, it in no way, the Church's doctrine, that is, of the Eucharistic sacrifice, in no way violates the once-for-all teaching of Hebrews 7:27. A second response is what I've already talked about in last week's episode, namely, that the Bible reveals that Christ continues to offer his very own sacrifice to the Father in an unbloody manner in the heavenly sanctuary. I'm not going to rehearse that answer here again. Check out last week's episode for the 30th Sunday of Ordinary Time Year B for details on that response. Now, the last thing we can say in response is that death is not essential to a sacrifice. And this is one of the things I point out in my book, Meeting the Protestant Challenge. One of the reasons why many Protestants think The once-for-all passage undermines the Eucharistic sacrifices because they think sacrifice must involve death. So if we're saying the Mass is a sacrifice of Christ, it must involve death, right? This is why they immediately think that the Eucharistic sacrifice is a re-crucifixion of Jesus. For these people, to speak of sacrifice is to speak of death. And since Jesus died only once, the Eucharist cannot be his sacrifice. But this is not the only way that the Bible views sacrifice. The Old Testament is full of drink offerings and grain offerings, for instance, neither of which involves death. There was also the wave offering, in which the gift was waved before God to present it to him. This type of sacrifice didn't involve the destruction of the gift. So, for example, in Numbers 8, 11 through 21, it records God's instructions for Aaron to, quote, offer the Levites before the Lord as a wave offering from the people of Israel, close quote. That's verses 11 and 13. This act constituted the Levites as ministers of the tabernacle, bestowing upon them the duty to do service for the people of Israel at the tent of meeting, there in verse 19. Similarly, Paul tells the Christians in Rome to, quote, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship, close quote. That's Romans 12:1. We don't allow ourselves to be killed as a sacrifice. Rather, we are to present ourselves as wave offerings to the Lord. It's this type of offering that Jesus makes of himself before God in the heavenly sanctuary. Christ sort of, quote unquote, waves the offering of his body and blood to the Father as a living sacrifice. Because it's the same priest making the offering, Jesus, the same victim, Jesus, his body and his blood, and the same person to whom the offering is made, the Father, it's the same sacrifice. The only difference is that his sacrifice in heaven doesn't involve him shedding his blood and dying. It's offered in an unbloody way, since the shedding of his blood was done once for all on the cross, according to Hebrews 7:27. So that completes our reflection on the second reading. Several apologetical nuggets there. Now we turn to the gospel reading. Mark records this. One of the scribes came to Jesus and asked him, which is the first of all the commandments? Jesus replied, the first is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. The second is this. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. The scribe said to him, well said, teacher, you're right in saying. He is one and there is no other than he. And to love him with all your heart, with all your understanding, with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is worth more than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. And when Jesus saw that he had answered with understanding, Jesus said to him, you're not far from the kingdom of God. And no one dared to ask him any more questions. Notice Jesus tells the scribe that he's correct in knowing that love of God and love of neighbor are the greatest. And it's this knowledge that puts him close to the kingdom of God. But the question naturally arises, what's lacking for him to actually be in the kingdom of God? I think the implied answer is living it, living the commandments of love of God and love of neighbor, not just knowing it. The implication is that if the scribe lives out the commandments of loving God and neighbor, then he will be in the kingdom of God. Now, if that's the case, then love would be the ground for membership in God's kingdom. Given that to be a member of God's kingdom is to be justified, or at peace with God, and thereby no longer subject to condemnation, it follows that love for God and love of neighbor is the ground for our justification. It is love in our heart, which is that in virtue of which we are at peace with God and right relationship with him, i.e. justified. But love is something that's interior. It involves the will being properly ordered to the good of another, both to God's goodness, which our wills rejoice in because he is goodness itself, and our neighbor's goodness, which we desire they come to possess. So from this, it follows that our justification is rooted or grounded in something interior to us, the love of God poured forth into our hearts. It's this love of God in our hearts that serves as the ground in virtue of which I am at peace with God or justified. Therefore, the belief that our justification is merely forensic, that's to say, the ground for our being at peace with God is merely, only an extrinsic declaration by God that we're at peace with him, is false. Our gospel reading here provides us evidence that our justification is rooted in something interior in us, namely the love of God poured forth within our hearts. Well, my friends, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Sunday Catholic Word, the readings for this upcoming 31st Sunday of Ordinary Time, Year B. The second reading and the gospel reading give us opportunities to reflect on the sacrifice of the Mass, the intercession of the saints, and justification and its relation to love. All three are very much relevant for doing apologetics. As always, thank you for subscribing to the podcast. Please be sure to tell your friends about it and invite them to subscribe as well at SundayCatholicWord.com. You might also want to check out the other great podcasts in our Catholic Answers Podcast Network. Trent Horns, The Council of Trent, Joe Heschmeyer, Shameless Popery, Jimmy Akins, A Daily Defense, Tim Staples, 101 with Tim, all of which can be found at Catholic.com. And one last thing, if you're interested in getting some cool mugs and stickers with my logo, Mr. Sunday Podcast, you can go to shop.catholic.com. Friends, I hope you have a blessed 31st Sunday of Ordinary Time, Year B. Until next time, God bless.
Thank you for listening to the Sunday Catholic Word. Find more great shows by visiting CatholicAnswersPodcasts.com or just search for Catholic Answers wherever you listen to podcasts.